Welcome to the GeoMob Podcast, where we discuss geo-innovation in any and all forms, whether for fun or profit.
And welcome back, listeners, to yet another episode of the GeoMob Podcast. I'm Denise McKenzie and your host for today. And we're going to be talking to Elena Field from British Antarctic Survey. Now, Elena and I have actually known each other by sort of name and digital environments through the Women Plus in Geospatial now for a number of years, but only recently got the chance to actually meet for the first time in person at Geospatial World Forum a couple of weeks ago. So that was fantastic fun. I should say too, that was where Elena picked up a Rising Star Award as well, which is one of the reasons I thought it would be great to talk to her today and talk a bit more about her work. So she's working at British Antarctic Survey, but is also a volunteer for Map Action as well and has done deployments with Map Action. So we'll talk a bit about that. We're going to talk a bit about time in Antarctica. She's actually been down there in person. So there'll be a lot that we'll go through. But I thought I'd start by asking Elena to give us a bit of an introduction to herself and her journey in getting to where she's working now. So Elena, over to you.
Hi, great to be here. So a little bit of background on me. I started with a geology degree originally, and as part of that I absolutely loved any part of the mapping side. Anything that I could be a bit more creative with but also throw in a little bit of science, I really enjoyed. And I think a lecturer basically sat me down and said, you're kind of average at most things but you're really good at mapping, which was hard to hear at first, but very good advice. And so I looked for any master's projects or roles that kind of allowed me to do a bit of both, and I settled on GIS. So after that I moved to do a master's in geospatial technology and cartography at Glasgow, which I absolutely loved. It's brilliant. And actually, as part of that, my master's project was focused on kind of polar research. So it was actually looking at the North Pole, so at thermokarst lakes, which are these lakes that are kind of created when permafrost degrade over time. And I just kept staring at this amazing imagery, this kind of beautiful snowy landscapes, and loving it. And happened to come across an advert at British Antarctic Survey for a GIS officer at the time. Ticked every box. It was a 2-year desk job, so I just thought, okay, I'll go and I'll experience BAS and see what I can do. And somehow, nearly 10 years on, I'm still working at BAS.
Amazing. Well, so I'm curious. So British Antarctic Survey, but we're in the UK. So tell me a bit more about BAS and what it does, and why on earth in the United Kingdom do we have a British Antarctic Survey area?
That's a good question. So the Antarctic Survey has got quite a long history behind it. It kind of goes all the way back to the Second World War and Operation Tabarin, where they kind of had a team kind of exploring and setting up bases there. But kind of British interest in Antarctica goes back up about over 200 years at this point. Kind of BAS's kind of main ethos is kind of polar research and being kind of that leading institute for polar research for the UK but internationally as well. And so we facilitate research. We have a huge vast array of scientists in-house, but we also have kind of logistics and operations under the same roof, which allows us to kind of facilitate all of this research really well. So we operate 5 stations in the Antarctic and a station in the Arctic as well.
Very cool. So, I mean, obviously this is the GeoMob podcast, so it would be remiss of us not to be talking about geospatial data. So talk to me a bit about your unit then and the sort of role that I guess geospatial is playing inside an organisation like BAS.
Yes, so I actually work in the MAGIC team, which stands for the Mapping and Geographic Information Centre. It's got to be one of the best acronyms, certainly at my organisation.
Easily. Yeah, I think that's one of the better unit names for geospatial, actually, to be in the MAGIC team.
It's pretty good. People do think we can perform miracles, though, which gets quite interesting. So kind of geospatial data really does underpin a lot of what pretty much everything that BAS does, because of kind of the remote locations that people work, and the kind of variety of different projects. There's a geospatial location element to absolutely everything, whether it's planning science, actually being out into the field, how do we get the people into the field, how do we then research the area using remote sensing if needed, how do we actually operate in these areas with such a huge distance to travel. So our team, we're quite a small team, there's 12 of us, and we kind of run the full gamut of kind of geospatial tech. So we go from surveyors all the way through to geospatial web development, and we have data collection, analysis, map production, web mapping, and then we're there as a help desk as well. So we run a really useful help desk for any scientists, any operations teams that need our support.
And are they just internal, or is that something that researchers can access from outside of BAS as well?
So our help desk is mostly internal. It's essentially any research that is affiliated with BAS that we can help with. For the operations side, we facilitate any operations that's going through a BAS research centre, research station.
So give me a flavour then, thinking about the projects you've worked on in the last 10 years. Have you got a favourite in there that has been really fantastic, or some of the ones you're doing currently at the moment? What are we researching inside the Antarctic at the moment?
So recently BAS is kind of just wrapping up this huge international collaboration. It's called the Thwaites Glacier Collaboration. And it was a product of over 5 years work, probably closer to 8 years all told. And it's based on around the Thwaites Glacier, which is in West Antarctic. It is in an area that is rapidly changing and has been observed to be changing at huge pace. And scientists are focusing on that area because it's potentially a proxy for what could happen later. What could happen if the ice sheet retreats too far. It's considered a pinch point or a tipping point. So scientists are kind of focused on this area and trying to understand all the different kind of history behind it, what's happened in the past, what's happening now, and what could happen in the future. And this was a massive international collaboration between the UK and the US. And it involved kind of huge logistic efforts. This is one of the most remote places you can get to in Antarctica. It's kind of right in between Rothera Research Station and McMurdo Research Station on the continent. So it's basically as far as you can get on either side.
And distance-wise, what are we talking then? So if we're thinking about those two stations, how far away from each other roughly are they?
Oh, God. I actually don't think I know the numbers there.
You're talking hours, days, like how long to kind of travel?
So it's really interesting because Antarctica's a very difficult place to travel in. You're talking minimum days to travel there. And it's an area that when you look at it on a map, you think it should only take one or two at most. The problem is, with the weather and anything else that could go wrong, you're talking at minimum, 4 or 5 days, accounting for, 3 days of layup because the weather is rubbish and you can't fly. Also, you have, it depends on the cargo. So if you're lugging loads of cargo, you can't go as far. So you have to do hops on very small aircraft. Certainly from the BAS side, we use twin otter aircraft. Primarily as our kind of workhorse going across the continent, and they operate through kind of shorter legs, so traditionally like under 2 hours at a time, but it's quite common that you could go through one site and you're planning to go to a third site later on that day. The weather looks fine when you leave, and when you get there it's completely turned and you're going to have to camp out. So there's always contingency plans. There's always kind of, okay, what do we do now? And sometimes the answer is you have to just wait until the weather clears.
So you've obviously done deployment down into Antarctica. Talk us through what was that like? I mean, I can imagine a mixture of excitement and also anxiety for myself. I can imagine going into that part of the world for the first time. When was this? What was it for? And what was it like?
Yes, I've been really lucky. I've gone to the Antarctic 7 times now.
That's awesome. Now I'm jealous because I haven't been once. Continent I haven't got to yet.
It's an incredible place. If you can get to it, please do. If you can, I really hope you do. It is very hard to describe, and I remember feeling when I first got to go, thinking this was my one and only chance to go. And every time I go, I think this is my last time I get to go, because every time is different and every time is really special. And whenever I leave, I always think, okay, if this is the last time I've seen this place, you know, I've taken everything I possibly can out of this, and I've loved every second. Not to say it's not really hard work, but I think the hard work makes it even more worthwhile.
So what sort of preparation do you do in sort of getting ready for a trip like that?
There's a lot of prep. So it's interesting. The first time I went, I was slightly naive to how much I needed to do. Or else I was just really poorly prepared. Before you go on any deployment to through VAS, you have a long stint of kind of preparation. So whether that's a medical, you have pre-deployment training, which is, I think now it's over 2 weeks, but when I first did it, it was one very intense week. That includes kind of a first aid course, how to prepare yourself, or how to layer polar clothing, etc. There's a lot to learn. You have a kitting set up where you go and try out all your polar gear, and you make sure it all fits and you're comfortable and you can manage everything. And that's all kind of before you go. And then you have 3 days of travel usually before you get there, as a minimum, I would say. If your weather's good and you make it very, very cleanly, it's about 3 days travel.
And what's the journey like? Where from? So if you're coming from the UK, what would my path through the world be to get down to Antarctica?
So the usual route is via southern Chile. So we would take flight from the UK down to Sao Paulo, across to Santiago, and then one more flight down to Punta Arenas in the southern tip of Chile. From there, you would normally, there's an air bridge, which is a Dash 7 aircraft operated by BAS, and it would take you the last leg down. The alternative is that you could go via Punta Arenas or via the Falklands via ship, which at the moment is the Sir David Attenborough. And that would take about 5 or 6 days usually. But unfortunately, because of the weather is so variable, you often don't find out if you're going, or you won't find out if you're going until the day of. And sometimes that changes. I've had deployments where you're all ready to go, you've been told you're ready to go, and then you're stood down for the day. Or the opposite, where you're told you're not going, and then 3 hours later they've found a weather window and everyone's got to go. Once you get to the southern tip of Chile, it's either a very long wait or no time at all. That's usually how it goes.
Yep.
Yeah.
So flying down, give me the Elaine. I mean, you know, you said it's hard to describe, but thinking back to that first moment where you set foot on the continent, what was that kind of? Give us a description. What's that like to kind of land and look out on Antarctica for the first time?
Just goosebumps. So even before you land, if you're lucky enough, you'll start seeing tiny bits of the continent before you get there. So often Antarctica is kind of cloudy a lot of the time, but when you get close to certainly Rothera Research Station, there's some very high, very tall mountains nearby, and they all start poking through. And the atmosphere on board, there's only about 12 to 16 passengers at a time, and the atmosphere on board is just electric. And you just can't quite believe you're seeing what you're seeing. Like, if you spot an iceberg, like, suddenly it becomes real. And like, certainly for me, I'd been looking at, you know, maps of the Antarctic and images and satellite imagery for, you know, a year before, just staring at all these places. And suddenly I was like, oh, wait, I know that place. We're actually landing there. And then setting foot out is just incredible. It's so bright. You have to wear very, very strong sunglasses, some Cat 4 sunglasses. But even then, it's quite bright. And you get welcomed by the station leader, which is always really amazing. And you're just kind of just staring. You just stare. It's so many blues. You always think of Antarctica as like very white, but it's a lot of blue. And yeah, it's just incredible.
So I guess project-wise, again, it's a geospatial podcast, so you were down there clearly not just for the sightseeing and the amazing blues. What are the projects? So in terms of, you know, how does a geospatial specialist land down in Antarctica? What are you doing while you're down in Antarctica?
Yeah, so my main role is geospatial support to operations and logistics. So I'm there primarily to kind of support any of the work that's going to set people out into the field. So whether that's land, sea or air. So when I'm there, I'm supporting people from the field, field guides team, field operations managers, any of the air units as well, and then anyone in around station. So I often end up setting up camp, and then people are just kind of going by my desk constantly asking for any kind of geospatial help. And either I'll be able to help them directly, or I'll be able to direct them to someone back in the office in Cambridge who's better placed. But yeah, my role is essentially just to be that support. So if they need any data, any information, just anything that will get them from A to B, then that's my main role when I'm there.
So making maps for these people for traveling, yeah. I guess then.
Yeah,
so
what, making little maps for them.
So what sort of tooling? What tools travel down with you, with Elena, to when she travels down for map making in Antarctica? So have you got a software of choice? What is amazing data coming through?
So that has changed a little bit over time. So traveling down, it used to be that I would travel down with a hard drive full of data as well. But then I set up with just a laptop and usually desktop GIS. So I use either ArcGIS or QGIS as well, whatever tool fits the bill. Our field operations team primarily use QGIS, so we support them with that. And then, yeah, making maps with whatever resource I need, really. But yes, now... I used to go down with a massive hard drive full of data that I would have to kind of get everything ready before I go, make sure I have all the images I could get my hands on, all the elevation models I could find, and then just desperately cling on to this hard drive as I went through all the commercial airlines. But now it's changed somewhat, and although I do still take a hard drive just as a backup, now we're a lot better connected, and we can actually download things a lot easier. So at a push, I can download a satellite image, which is a game changer now.
You said you've been doing this for 10 years. Mm-hmm. How recent is that sort of switch over and that connectivity has reached Antarctica in that way where it's easier to do that download? Is that last couple of years, 5 years ago?
I would say realistically the last couple of years.
Just
So when I first started, it was very much if you needed anything downloaded, it would have to be coordinated with our IT and it would trickle down. Because if you were trying to download anything, you know, over 50 megabytes, you would wipe out anything. And people would not be able to call home, and then you'd be very, very unpopular.
But it feels like back when I had dial-up internet as a kid, right? And sort of you'd be
the same thing.
Yeah, it was like plugged in, absolutely. And you get so annoyed at the family when someone picked up the phone to have a phone call.
That's exactly it.
Okay.
Over the past few years, this has massively improved, and it's also improved kind of people's day-to-day there as well. So previously it was a reliance on email, phone calls from a landline if you wanted to call home. Now people have WhatsApp and they can actually WhatsApp their families and they can have phone calls, and kind of the welfare aspect to that has massively improved, as well as making our jobs a lot easier.
So that's an interesting point there. When you're going down on deployment, how long are you going for?
So I'm actually on the shorter end of normal deployments. I average between 6 and 9 weeks, generally.
That's short.
That is short, yeah. So kind of traditionally, the kind of operations teams and any of the field parties, depending on the project, you have teams that are there for 6 months, during the summer season, which is roughly about 6 months. But you have winter teams who are there for 18 months at a time. So they'll do a summer, winter, summer, essentially. And then they'll hand over to the next winter team. Yeah.
That's incredible. I mean, I'm trying to imagine being sort of as beautiful as the place is, that must be a quite isolating sort of environment to be. But even then, 6 to 9 weeks is still quite a long time to be away.
Yeah, it is. It's an interesting time because when you're there, you have very long days. It's very busy. There isn't kind of a traditional week necessarily, in that, you know, you don't have a 9 to 5. You're working when you need to be doing the work, essentially. And the same for the others on station. Everyone's doing a job. There's always somebody doing something. And so the atmosphere is very active and very energetic. But then you get people doing kind of work, and then you're watching other people, you know, having rec and skiing down. Just, you can see people skiing nearby and you're like, okay, cool. You're having a rec day, that's great. But, you know, when I have a bit of a break, you're probably going to be working. So it's an interesting balance, and the station is always ticking along.
So I was curious about that. You just kind of alluded. So there is fun things to do in Antarctica. So what did you get up to on some of the, what's some of the fun, most fun things you've done while you were down on deployment?
I've been really lucky. I relearned how to ski when I was there. I used to ski when I was a young kid and then had, you know, 20 years of nothing and then had a lot of fear. But I'm happy to say I relearned how to ski when I was there. And there's a lot of kind of ski and snowboard opportunities there. And there's a lot of walking, which when you're on a very, very small space of land, you think would be very boring. But because of the environment you're in, it changes all the time. There's new icebergs, there's new seals, penguins around. You're not going to get bored. I end up personally doing a lot of walking when I'm there. But there's also kind of indoor recreation as well. So the new Discovery building that's recently kind of opened has a really large climbing wall, climbing wall, very popular. But there's also a music room, there's arts and crafts, there's TV rooms, there's like a little mini cinema room that's been made up with a projector. So if people want to put on a film in the evening, it's a really nice community kind of spirit there as well. There's a bit of everything. I think there's also recreational boat trips, which are incredible. They don't offer them necessarily routinely, but the boating team are incredible. And when they have availability on the boats, they'll put a call out and say if anyone would like to join them, people are welcome to. I've been lucky enough to join a couple of them. And it's often, you know, you're sat on a boat freezing, absolutely freezing, while a dive team is busy doing their science. But you get to see the area from a completely different perspective. It's just absolutely incredible. And, you know, you get a chance to be on a boat in Antarctica.
I'm going to be telling myself, my son is currently studying geography at A-levels at the moment, and he is really into climbing. So I'm going to mention to him, I said, you can get jobs working for, you know, Antarctic Survey, and they've even got a climbing wall down in Antarctica.
Yeah. You can be a field guide. That'd be amazing.
That would be awesome. So let's go back to some of the data then that's coming out. I know that one of the things that we've talked about previously is that, you know, this is obviously, it's a research organization. So one of the big things for BAS is also getting open data out to those around the world. Can you give us a sense, I guess, of those researchers and that sort of data? You know, how are you playing their role in getting that data out to the rest of the world? And what's it doing, I guess, as far as research goes?
Yes. So geospatial data is one of the more open data that we have in BAS that's we kind of publish. We manage the Antarctic Digital Database on behalf of SCAR, which is the Scientific Committee of Antarctic Research. And as part of that, it's a huge international effort. And we host and manage the data sets, which is all of the topographic data for Antarctica. It's updated every 6 months. Which seems excessive, but Antarctica changes so much, it's actually quite a lot of work each time. And that is a primary resource for any kind of Antarctic science. So you're talking coastlines, any rock outcrop, contours, any of the kind of really base topographic information that all of the research and studies can be built from. And that's a primary data set that we manage in our team.
So I guess thinking, you know, this is one of those probably quite sad answer questions I'm sure I'm about to ask here, but you've been doing this for 10 years. Of all those data sets, what's the kind of one that you've just is so completely stark in terms of its change and not change in a good way kind of thing? I imagine that Antarctica is one of those places that you unfortunately see an awful lot of the not good change in our world is becoming quite visible. Is there one that you can think of where it's like actually so stark inside this data set that we work on?
The coastline, I think, would be the obvious answer to that. Mainly, but it's an interesting one because you're seeing a lot of change for lots of different reasons. And some of it is natural, and some of it is kind of natural but progressed at a pace that is not natural. And so we're seeing some areas change much more rapidly than other areas. And then we have, in some cases, areas that change in one big jump. So ice shelves are a really good example of it, where we can see, so there's a few ice shelves that we, you know, BAS and other organisations watch for years because they know that there's going to be massive calving events. And when they do, they are really quite obvious and huge and impactful. And then have a massive iceberg that can be tracked all the way back up, which has its own research element as well. But for us, for me personally, I find the kind of smaller changes more impactful. So you see areas that, you know, every 6 months there's a retreat, or, you know, there's this one pinch point where there's a rock outcrop that is clearly been pinning this bit of ice around, and that's the ice is now gone, and that rock is now no longer pinned, it's now an island. It's quite interesting to see.
So there's more and more land becoming visible in those coastline areas.
It's interesting because there's a combination of factors at play here, where there's improved data. So we can actually, like, the observational remote sensing data we're using is better resolution. And so we can just identify stuff. And there's an element of, was this always there and we just couldn't see it? Or has this retreated? But then there's obvious areas where, okay, that has retreated. That used to be an ice rise, what we thought was an ice rise. Actually, that was always an island, but the ice shelf was over it. And so it's quite interesting to see over the years that has increased.
Interesting. Well, for all of those listeners on here, I know we have a number of you that love to get your hands on some good open data. You'll have to go and have a look at the BAS library and make sure that you can get your hands on this and do some research with that. So conscious that we've been talking now for probably close to our time, but I don't want us to leave this discussion without getting a bit into Map Action, which is one of those charities that I know is dear to my heart and dear to the heart of many of those of us in the UK. I know you've done deployment and so forth with them. Do you want to just give the listeners, for those that don't know what Map Action is, give us a sense of what that is as an organisation, and then we can get a bit into the deployment that you've done with them as well.
Yeah, sure. So Map Action is a humanitarian charity based in the UK, and it is kind of volunteer driven, and volunteers are geospatial experts, data experts, and essentially we're just it's a group of people who are really, really keen to make a difference. The kind of motto is no one should be left behind where data could have helped, which I think is something we all get behind as data people. And yeah, it's an incredible charity. And if you haven't heard of it, please have a look.
Awesome. So how did you get involved? How did you get into Map Action, and what have you done as one of those volunteers?
So I'd heard of Map Action quite a few years ago. I'd been involved in like Missing Maps and Humanitarian OpenStreetMap. There was kind of a Missing Maps kind of, I think every month or every 2 months, there was a Missing Maps kind of workshop. And then I think when I was there, a few people from Map Action or who volunteered at Map Action were also there, and we got to talking. And I learned a lot more about it. One of my colleagues in my team joined Map Action as well. And so I got to hear a lot more about it from him. And it just seemed as interesting as I thought it had. Like actually, when I actually got to talk to someone who'd experienced it, it was still just as good as I was hoping it would be. So yeah, I just decided one day I'm just going to go for it and apply. And they seemed to want me to join. It was great.
Awesome. And so where have you ended up being deployed?
So I've been on a training deployment and an emergency deployment. My training deployment was to Senegal, where we were teaching QGIS over 3 or 4 days, which was really, really good. And then my emergency deployment was to Barbados and St. Vincent and the Grenadines.
Very cool. So when you say emergency deployment, what's the sort of emergencies that Map Action are responding to?
It varies, but primarily it's any humanitarian emergency. So quite often it's natural disasters. So my emergency deployment was following Hurricane Beryl, which kind of decimated St. Vincent and the Grenadines, and then went on and decimated Jamaica as well. So when it comes to an emergency deployment, it's often very short notice, as these things often are. You're a small team, there's usually only about two of you, and then you're essentially put on a plane with a huge load of equipment and off you go. It's really quite exciting.
So it sounds similar to going to Antarctica in that sense.
Yeah, there's a lot of similarities there, for sure.
And so when you're on the ground, so in that environment, who are you making maps for? Who are you kind of helping most? What's the impact that Map Action is trying to have when they're out helping in these humanitarian situations?
Yeah, so often in these situations, there's often a National Emergency Management Office called ANEMO, or there's a kind of centre kind of developed where it's loads of different kind of local groups, local government, who are leading kind of the response, plus any invited NGOs or any kind of extra aid that has been requested. And then what Map Action are trying to do is we're essentially trying to distill lots of the information that's coming in from different directions, and then putting it in one place so then people can make decisions better. Often the information is coming from, you know, you get a little bit of information from one team, and then actually you need to join it with the information this other team has been given in order for it to make it actually useful for the next decision. So it's to enable the people on the ground to be able to make the decisions faster and more efficiently.
Sounds like an incredibly important piece of work. If I were a, you know, aspiring geospatial professional and I was keen to volunteer, how would I go about doing that with MapAction? What's kind of involved and what's my commitment if I'm going to do that?
Yes, so MapAction we run kind of volunteer drives every year, every couple of years. It's an application, as you would expect for any kind of job. And what is kind of expected from a volunteer? We run training sessions, so it's like a weekend, usually camping somewhere rainy, every couple of months.
Sounds appealing.
Well, you know, it attracts quite a lot of people, surprisingly enough. these weekends are really great. So you get to learn kind of the process, how it all works, how to work together. Different volunteers run different sessions. So recently there was a social media session, which was really interesting. And the commitment is essentially you have to attend half of these training sessions a year. There's usually a kind of MapX as well, which is an exercise to make sure that we're all prepared for any emergency deployment. And then there's a minimum of kind of expected level about 10 days a year of volunteer work. So that can be a variety of different things. It doesn't have to be an emergency deployment. There's a lot of anticipatory reaction work. There's a lot of training materials. There's the kind of training deployments as well, which I was lucky enough to go to first and kind of got my kind of hand in and understood how it works a bit better through that, before I felt confident doing kind of the emergency deployment. So there's a lot there, and you don't have to be a core GIS user to volunteer as well. There's a lot of different kind of roles, and there's a lot of experience there. So even if you're just interested in mapping, then I think there's probably a space for you.
It means there's hope for someone like me. As my friends will know, I might have worked in the field of geospatial for a long time, but actually making maps these days is probably not my best quality skill set. I'll leave that to the experts these days. Elena, thank you so much for talking with me today. It's been a really fascinating journey. You've now absolutely inspired me. I want to go and see all these different blues of the Antarctic and see that one for myself. So I'll be certainly looking for those opportunities for doing that. But it does sound like you're doing amazing work. So listeners, go and check out the BASS website if you want to have a look at the library. And if you've been inspired by MapAction, do look up the website and have a look for when that next volunteer drive is going to be. But Elena, thank you so much for sharing all of that with us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Brilliant. Thanks, everybody. That's the end of our GeoMob podcast for today. And we'll be back with someone new, fascinating and interesting for our next one. Bye, everyone.
Thanks for joining us today on the GeoMob podcast. We hope you enjoyed the discussion. You can get the show notes over on the website, which is at thegeomob.com. And while you're there, you can sign up for our monthly newsletter and find links to our accounts on Mastodon and LinkedIn so that you can stay up to date on all our upcoming events. We hope to see you at an event soon.